Hey, Project Big Screen listeners, you can find us every Monday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Feeling lucky? You should be. Meet the new Lucky One Sweet Tea from Miss Peaches, the vodka drink that's positively doing good. Made with real tea and real vodka, non-carbonated, 100 calories. And here's the scoop. Their new sweet tea is the only vodka-based sweet tea on the market. Simple ingredients in a smooth, full flavor that makes it taste just like the real sweet tea. Best part? Every can helps rescue dogs find their forever homes as they work to a goal of donating $1 million to dog rescues in 2026. So if you love true sweet tea, this one's a no-brainer. Pick up a Lucky One sweet tea today and give back one can at a time.
Welcome to Lights, Camera, Bars, episode 372. Jeff Lowe, Ken Jack, Joe Ballins. Happy July 4th-ish. We had one podcast last week, two this week. Though if you're listening to this years down the line or months down the line, timing doesn't matter. But yeah, we had one last week, two this week. So that was our holiday podcast. But now we're on here, July 5th, 2021, talking Tomorrow War and talking to Malcolm D. Lee, who's a director of many things, but more specifically, excuse me, Space Jam, A New Legacy. So we have an interview with him today about that. It was actually a great conversation about that and many other things as well. Barbershop, The Next Cut. Mm-hmm. He talked about directing Scary Movie 5, was very not like candid for a while about it. It was like, yeah, I don't love that one. It's like not happy. It's on my resume. Not to spoil the interview too much.
And the Hot Wheels movie that we thought he was part of because it's on his IMDb and wiki, but he's not part of it at all, which is very funny.
So, good interview. Fun time with him. But what's happening other than that? What's going on, Trill?
And not much with me, man. My parents are in town visiting. Helping with the baby. So it's been good. I don't know, man. I want to point out Ken Jack's on a gaming headset, which I think is the coolest way to podcast and probably the way God designed podcasting.
I left my microphone at home, so I had to go to Target and pick this one up. It actually kind of rules because I can like turn my head in any direction. I have a full 360 view of operations that I can do right now, and I can still talk and you still hear the same level of gain.
We got free hands too, right?
Like, dude, I have free hands to destroy this white castle that I have. I bought and came back with. I got those mini cheeseburgers that they're looking at right now. This is some ASMR for you. You can hear the cardboard box. Oh,
see, it's weird how you said white castle. I know like nobody will ever feel that way, but for me it's like white castle's always blended into like one word. It's like white castle.
White castle.
But you were like White Castle. You took a pause in between White Castle.
Okay, fair
it's
enough.
Like when it's like Best Buy. Like we talked about this before. Yes. I go Best Buy. Best Buy. Some people go Best Buy.
I want to point out that their fries, this is the first time I've had White Castle that wasn't frozen from the supermarket in a long time. Their fries have gotten exponentially better. Significantly better. It's amazing. I'm loving them right now.
I love White Castle.
If you ever want to get sick, buy some White Castle frozen burgers. You got a good, you got a coin flip. If you're like, if you're just jonesing for a stomach ache, go get those because it's a complete coin flip. Yeah.
And do not cook them in a convection oven. Make sure you microwave those suckers. That's what I'm talking about. How God intended. Those things are meant to be just thawed out in the middle. And that's it from a microwave oven.
Have I ever told you about like my White Castle experience in undergrad? Like me and my friends had an exam. We were cramming for it. And we ordered a bunch of White Castles. And then before the exam, I had that mixture of anxiety plus like White Castle digestion. And I went into the bathroom and did that. And then when I flushed it, like it sprayed back up on my sleeve. That was the first time it sprayed up on my sleeve.
Oh no.
So I always associate White Castle with that. I don't know why that's happened to me so many times. I'm probably going to the bathroom wrong.
I was going to say, I think you're just shitting in the cigar.
I don't know how to go to the bathroom.
Well,
I've been watching Impractical Jokers.
Me too.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, they've been just running them nonstop on True TV. And been watching them with my parents at night.
They run it nonstop on True TV 24/7.
It's their ridiculousness.
It's not like a marathon. It's just what they do.
Yeah.
They had TV. I started watching the movie and it didn't hit the same. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't have the same feel as the TV show.
Paula Abdul subplot didn't really do it for you.
No. But I was watching the one last night where they were celebrating their 200th episode, and they had Kevin Smith and Jason Mewes on playing Jay and Silent Bob in character. And then one of the guys got into a big kick drum. That was pretty funny.
You like Pants People? That was a good one.
And Practical Jokers is on it. I'm not going to say it's on as much as Ridiculousness, but notice how nobody complains about Impractical, because Impractical Jokers is a funny show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's enjoyable. Whereas Ridiculousness, I actually did watch some of that the other night. And Rob went into this big monologue of like, I forget what he called it. Like, I don't know, just going into hulking out. He went into this hulking out monologue about what it means to hulk out. And it just went into clips of people breaking lamps with hammers. Like, they're just showing anything on that show that they can find on YouTube.
I use that term all the time, hulking out. It's a very regular term that people use in their day-to-day life.
Speaking of things coming back up, by the way, I'm going to tell a gross story, so tune out if you don't like this. So I'm staying at a shore house right now. We have a shore house for the summer based from this High Noon Barstool's America show, which is on YouTube. Go check it out. Awesome show. It's a fucking ton of fun to do. So we got this house. It's an old 115-year-old house. It's the oldest house in this town. Cool house, cool interior, like get the very like old, like rickety but cool Jersey Shore vibe. Anyway, you got to assume there's plumbing issues here. It's a standard thing for a house this old. Like the fact that I found a plug to plug my computer in is kind of crazy. Like in an accessible spot to podcast.
The people in like 1967 just had smaller poops. Is what it comes down to.
That is, yep, yeah. Back. So there's a basement. I'll try not to get too gross if people aren't into poop stuff. And the plumbing and sewer stuff just started backing up big time. So every time the toilet flushed or the shower turned on, water just started coming up into the basement through the shower and the toilet. Fast forward to now, with a plumber coming out, never a good sign when a plumber walks into a bathroom and goes, "Holy fuck." That's never the amount. Look, I'm sure he's seen a lot of it in his day, but when it's that much shocking amount of poop water, that is just like, I mean, we've done a great, like the house is clean. There was like 15, like very, like kept it great. And then this problem arose last second. And when the plumber says, "Holy fuck," that's never a good sign.
He literally deals with shit for a living. If you can't deal with that shit, that's really bad.
Plumbing in general, like, just boggles my mind. The skill set required to do that in my head, like, not even just like the shitty parts of it, pun intended, but like the tight spaces you have to get into to deal with it. I don't know. But what if he was just like saying "holy fuck" because it was like a Kohler 100 model? Like an antique toilet. It's like, wow, this is a collector's toilet.
He's never seen it before. It's like, this is incredible. It's vintage.
Like a chain pole toilet.
He brought one tool in and he like looked at his tool. He was like, shit, this ain't happening.
One day I'm going to get an industrial toilet in my house. Just something you'd find at an airport with like the hole cut out of the seat.
Yeah. It sucks down the toilet. It's like a full whirlpool. Like nothing could escape that.
It's gone.
Like you're pretty sure if you put your hand in there, your arm would be sucked in, mm-hmm. ripped off. Yeah.
So did he take care of the problem or is it still like lingering?
Yeah, he's currently doing it right now. We were delayed in starting the pod to make sure he was all good. He's like, yeah, he goes, we'll fix it. He goes, this is quite insane, I believe is what he said. So it's a fun little problem to run into. It's like, this has been here for a while. We're like, oh, okay. So we inherited a very backed up sewage line.
Just fossilized.
He actually said, I'm going to go open up the sewer like main in the back. And he goes, I'm a little worried. And I was like, why? He goes, because there's a chance when I pop that top off, it could just explode right out. I was like, oh my God. Like so cartoon level stuff.
I know, dude. It's
crazy. Oh my God.
You could like drill through it and then you could tell like almost with ice layers, like when something came from. Like, oh, this is from an old restaurant. That's like, what's like an old restaurant that's like gone defunct? They're like going through like, this is McDonald's. You know, this could be any time in the last 60 years. This is from like Pizza Haven. Yeah, this has to be at least like a 30-year-old shit here.
Oh my God. Anyway, anything else less gross? Any Joe, you cook out for 4th of July? Any food stories?
No. We ate out. That's like one of the best parts about having your parents visit you is, you know, getting to eat out. And
this is the Call Her Daddy portion of the podcast.
Fuck.
Oh,
no. No.
Come on.
He did that thing where he dropped the quip and then he muted. Like,
I'm eating a mini burger, dude.
No,
okay?
I feel like that's the podcast version of a mic drop when you know you got a good quip in there, just going on mute. No. So we've been no cooking out. And what about you? You mean you grilling dogs? You flipping burgers?
Yeah, we grilled some burgers, grilled some dogs, did just the typical fare, the typical fanfare of July 4th. Had a great buffalo chicken dip this weekend. Ooh. I've moved in. I'm fully when it comes to bagged chips. I'm fully a blue corn tortilla guy. Mm-hmm.
The fare is a great name for food. It always makes it seem like we have this style fare. That always makes it seem more appetizing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a more sophisticated, advanced way to
like
describe
an offering.
Like,
with
which brand of blue corn?
I actually like little tip for those out there. Whole Foods blue corn, pretty solid. But I think Tostitos, like the white bag Tostitos blue corn tortilla chips, are fantastic. Yeah. The worst are the store brand Target. I think Target store brand has become pretty terrible. It's not great.
Yeah, I actively avoid everything they make. And their food section is, I think they have a good trail mix. That's kind of good. Like a couple of their things in their nut and whatever candy sort of aisle. That's good. But like anything else is just very much an avoid section for me.
I'm a big Fixer Upper fan, but I'll tell you what, Chip and Joanna's like contract or whatever with Target has fucked up Target. You just can't find anything in the middle of Target anymore because it's just all Chip and Joanna stuff.
The dead center of Heart the store home, always. Yeah.
It's growing. It's almost like it's like a parasite in the store. It just grows throughout the store. Like every time you go into a Target, you're like, there's just more Chip and Joanna and less of just like essentials and staples.
Yeah, and the thing that makes me mad about it is it's like, I'm sure a lot of people appreciate that, but like, I don't enjoy that. I don't like that whole aesthetic. I don't like, you know, walking by and saying, well, I'm going to find some stuff in my home. And it's just like this old looking alarm clock that's like $22 with the two bells on top of it, or a mailbox, you know, the one that's like tiered mailbox for your desks that's like rustic looking. It's just a bunch of knickknacks that I have no use for. Now keep in mind, I don't have a good design aesthetic, so I don't know if I'm off base or not, but it's like Target's like 25% that and then 25% Funko Pops.
Do you want, here's the thing I want to buy, the Chip and Joanna section, not to go off tangent, but there's one thing I saw last time I was there, which was like, it was a $15 set wooden salt and pepper shakers. And I was just like, I don't understand how this could even be like maybe even healthy. Like, I feel like I don't know how salt and pepper goes bad, but I feel like wood accelerates that process versus metal or plastic.
I don't even use salt and pepper shakers because you can buy them in a vessel that you could already pour out of the vessel.
Yes, exactly. It's so much easier.
I know it's so lazy, but that's how my stupid brain works. And my wife hates it because it is lazy.
It's lazy, but it's more efficient.
I'm just dumping that navy blue Morton sea salt container out in my plate.
Yeah. The one that's like this big too. It's just,
yeah. With the metal bird beak dispenser on top of it. Pouring salt. It's like pouring salt on my Hostess cakes.
Oh, come on. Oh.
Well, sweet and savory, sweet and salty.
Sweet. You wait, no, you don't do that. Please
no,
don't.
I don't. I can't eat Hostess cakes anymore. So no, I don't. Okay. But no, I don't. I have some disgusting food habits. Like I put A1 sauce on baked potatoes.
Not that crazy.
No, I put ketchup on pizza rolls. That's always been my big one. People just find completely disgusting.
The sauce inside isn't that dissimilar from ketchup. No,
I mean,
that's like a crazy thing.
It's chunky ketchup.
Yeah, it's more better seasoned ketchup. I don't think that's crazy. I think I've done that before. Maybe that's why I don't think it's crazy, though.
If you're ever for some reason in Waco, Texas, Chip and Joanna's Magnolia Market at the Silo is crazy. Crazy massive stuff. They're about to become big media moguls too. They got their channel launching. Anyway,
it's funny though, because that's like, I feel like that's this, we're going to look back on that in 20 years, that whole design aesthetic, and it's going to date like this, a decade, like maybe not 2010s, maybe it'd be like 2015 through 2025. In the same way in the 90s, like glass block windows and like stucco did. I don't know. Like, you know, design's cyclical, right? That maybe they can evolve, but I always picture them having that one aesthetic where like every door is a sliding door.
Yeah, like a sliding barn door.
You know what,
yeah,
it's called, sure, right? Their design aesthetic. The one that she used, like
barn?
What they're known for, shiplap.
Shiplap?
That's what they're known for.
But I thought shiplap was like the wood stuff.
Yeah, but that's like, that's...
It's just shiplap. Like, it's just
Joanna's thing, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I think in the right context, it looks good, but I certainly think it's like anything else. It, you know, tastes change and evolve. And you look at the way houses are being built right now, like where things are going up and everything is just so sterile and clean. And you compare that to 30 years ago where everything was, you know, maybe a little different from that.
Mm-hmm.
I like, you're so right on the type of stuff that you see in their section at Target. Cause I just pulled it up on target.com and one of them is a record player inside of a briefcase.
Oh man.
A candle holder. That's a fox holding the candle. a tea towel made out of a burlap sack.
Yes. No, I saw actually something like that. It was a pillow. It's like a miniature.
Like there's
a pillow so like small. I don't know what we do with
cornhole
it.
Cornhole boards.
Joanna cornhole board.
You just, I'm telling you, can't go into Target and then go in a month later. You're like, whoa, there's less essentials and there's more Chip and Joanna. That's my main takeaway. Though I do watch, I'm a fixer upper fan, so who am I to talk?
A letter opener that is really just a gardening hoe.
This episode brought to you by Mack Weldon. Summertime. Big time summertime. Mack Weldon, much more than just their underwear, which we've mentioned all the time. See, now they're pushing things that aren't their underwear, but people who listen know we've been doing that for a long time. T-shirts, polos, button-ups, button-downs, shorts, pants, swim trunks, all that, so much more. Even just simple stuff that we mention all the time, card holders. It's the summer. Maybe you're traveling, you're going somewhere. Their travel bags or stuff are awesome. Dop kits, all that. They have the weekender bag is great. Fits a bunch of shoes. Any weekender bag that can fit a bunch of shoes, that's a huge win. That way you don't have to carry anything extra, nothing much bigger than that. They'll keep you cool and comfortable all summer long. The breathable stuff that they have, it's cool. It makes you feel like you're not dressing down or wearing anything thin just to not feel hot. So it looks nice. The tech they have, and whether it's their shorts or their shirts, it keeps you cool all summer long, but also looking great. They got their swim line, board short options, all that as well. Mack Weldon. And the best part is about Mack Weldon too. First of all, you get that loyalty program, you get free shipping. And then when you reach level two by spending $200, you get 20% off every order for the next year. And you're going to want their fall and winter essentials as well. So stay cool in the summer, get Mack Weldon stuff. Now it's the beginning of July. We got a lot of time left in the summer. So for 20% off your first order, visit Mack Weldon, MackWeldon.com/lights and a promo code lights. That's Mack Weldon, MackWeldon.com/lights, promo code lights for 20% off Mack Weldon. They're reinventing basics, fantastic stuff, simple, clean, I'd almost say minimalistic look. Lots to get into trailer wise today. Tons of stuff. Many Saints of Newark. That's the big one off the top. The Sopranos prequel movie. It'll be releasing in October 1st. It'll be on HBO Max and in theaters. This trailer, I'll read the synopsis and we'll talk about it quick. Young Anthony Soprano is growing up in one of the most tumultuous eras in Newark's history, becoming a man just as rival gangsters begin to rise up and challenge the all-powerful, the male crime family's hold over the increasingly race-torn city. Caught up in the charred, changing times is the uncle he idolizes, who struggles to manage both professional and personal responsibilities, and whose influence over his nephew will make him the impressionable teenager into the all-powerful mob boss for later. Come to know Tony Soprano. Michael Gandolfini, obviously that's the biggest thing that everyone notices, if they didn't know this already. He is the son of James Gandolfini, who obviously played the character he's playing, the younger version, Tony Soprano. Everyone noted it. Who didn't know already? We knew it. We've talked about it. He looks so much like it. It's just crazy. It's like one of the more incredible and also awesome natural fits for a role you'll ever see. Leslie Odom Jr., John Bernthal, Ray Liotta in it, in the most Ray Liotta fucking role ever. Mm-hmm. Corey Stoll's in it. Vera Farmiga's in it. Billy Magnuson. I'll tell you what. I didn't know what to expect. I'm not as like Kenjick. You're definitely more of a Sopranos fan. I think you are as well, Trill. Like, but I've watched the whole thing twice. I've been waiting to do a rewatch. I'm going to start this week. I cannot wait. This, I don't know if I was like worried about it, but you just don't know. You're like, prequel to a TV show via movie. Like the Breaking Bad movie was awesome, right? Like that was a cool thing. But you're like, you kind of wanted it to be bigger than that. I thought this trailer was fucking awesome. And the reaction seemed to be the case as well. And what the best part of the trailer was, theme song hitting at the end of the trailer when the title card came up. That was, you kind of got like a little goosebumpy. You're like, oh shit, this actually could be pretty awesome.
That was a very, very smart move. I think that ending bit. I think with this, I was more excited for it than I was with El Camino, only because with Breaking Bad, I was more worried going into it that it would be like, not ruin the ending of Breaking Bad, because it's just that I had a high reverence for the ending of Breaking Bad and how they wrap things up. And I was like, I don't know how much more you need to add to that. Both Many Saints in Newark, I feel like it's different because they get to explore with like something in like a more prequel movie. You get to talk about all these stories that are referenced in passing in the show, which is really cool, because I think during the show, you hear about, you know, Uncle Dickie all the time. I guess Tony would talk about him, and getting to see him in action, getting to see like Tony's father, who isn't someone you really get a ton of in the series. Seeing like all these characters that brought to life and seeing Michael Gandolfini get to step into his dad's shoes is super, super cool. And it also, just based off the trailer, it seems like they worked the movie or the script so that it's not overly depending on Michael Gandolfini as an actor, because he's obviously relatively new to this. I think the only thing we've seen him in before this is Cherry, probably. So I think if they worked it to make it more of like a grand story than more than like a personal one for Michael Gandolfini. So I think letting him balance that load off on some of the other great actors in this movie is smart. But I'm excited. Look good. Look way better than I had a medium expectation going into it. It's definitely higher now because that trailer was very, very good.
Yeah, I think the general issue with something like El Camino is it revolves around the character that you don't care about as much as the character you want to see.
Yeah.
And I know there's probably a lot of, you know, Jesse stands out there who really enjoyed it, but I think for a large portion of Breaking Bad,
someone just shut the podcast off. Just a huge,
oh like, my god,
it's like fucking
Aaron, you wouldn't believe what these assholes said about you. Your character Jesse Pinkman from Breaking Bad, remember that one? Well, this one obviously is about the character, the Tony Soprano character. And I only say that because I think that's like, I guess it's easy to draw comparisons to El Camino because they are like, you know, reaching back into a very successful franchise and making a new movie off of it. And one at one point or another probably seems somewhat unexpected. But I think like my excitement level for this is because it does, you know, does revolve around the Tony Soprano character and of course his son playing him. I think that makes this movie on its face just as potential movie a lot more intriguing. Not saying anything about the quality of the movie or anything about how good I think it's going to be, just about the hype for it. That being said, like I'm not like, I need to rewatch Sopranos. I think there's a lot of things in there just because of when I watched it, I missed, and I tried to start rewatching and just put it down. The only thing I really noticed, which I thought was kind of interesting, is Vera Farmiga looked a lot like Carmilla in this. Mm. I think those touches are pretty, like, they're not subtle. I think they obviously, you want to catch on to that because obviously I think, you know, a lot of what Tony has to deal with is, I mean, I don't know, you could play armchair psychologist on it, but I think there'll be, my hope is that there'll be a lot of cool stuff like that, like put in this movie that does a little more of like, allows you to go a little more in the mind of Tony Soprano and his origin story a little bit. How much people are asking for it, I don't know, but it looks cool.
Yeah, the comments that we've seen, just like the development, this is very interesting because it kind of goes against the grain of stuff like this that is sort of forced through. because it just makes sense. And I'm not, and that's not me saying that's what the Breaking Bad one was. So the, like, I'll put that one aside, but you have a bunch of people who, you know, like David Chase, writer and producer of the movie. So it's like, I was against the movie for a long time, still very worried about it, but I became interested in Newark. My parents came from and where the rides took place. Like, so like there's some interest behind it in terms of like a personal connection. And that's where I think this can have a different kind of angle compared to other things, whether they're prequels to movies or sequels. There's just a different vibe. The more you like look at kind of production and how people feel about this. I wasn't pre-trailer. I didn't think it'd be like bad or anything, but you're still like, all right, let's see it. Let's see what it really looks like. And the idea of Michael Gandolfini playing his dad's character is great. But then until you see it, I think now I didn't see anyone who wasn't bought in it in terms of trailers that we've posted on social. This was one of the craziest reactions we've ever seen. People were just over the moon about it. Just saying like, holy shit, like need this now, all in. So clearly we'll talk about a couple of trailers in a second. Clearly this was the reaction that you want from a trailer. Cause it doesn't give it, it really only just kind of sets the table. Like it doesn't give too much away, but it gives people who probably are fairly skeptical no reason to be skeptical, at least going into it.
Yeah. But and obviously The Sopranos, one of, even at the time, right, one of the most critically acclaimed TV shows of all time. I think it really ushered in like what you consider the modern age of prestige television. And unlike, I mean, I think there are a lot of shows you can say that when they're airing and then go back and be like, okay, well, like it was good for the time. But I think like The Sopranos is pretty, I don't want to say it's unique because there are other shows like this, but it is one of those shows that only gets better as it ages. The interesting part about this is David Chase finishing The Sopranos in 2007. And then I think really only directing Not Fade Away in 2012. And like, I'm sure he's been working and producing on other things like that, but like in terms of directing and writing, it kind of seems like, you know, he was done, mic drop after The Sopranos. And for him to come back to this, I think that's really interesting because, you know, as the creator of something, like how do they feel about the character? How do their perceptions about their own creation change over time? Do they or do they not? So it's going to be interesting for a lot of different reasons, but I also think it's going to be, like you're saying, super hype, not only because there's a lot of people my age who remember The Sopranos from being that show at the time, but even people who I think like Ken Jack, maybe not you, but maybe even people a little bit younger than you, or maybe like born in the later part of the 90s who were babies when the show came out, who are kind of discovering it for the first time via streaming services and just a lot of the buzz and almost like a second win for the show when its popularity in the last couple of years.
For sure. That's definitely one that's been rediscovered. I don't think in the same sort of like viral, easy to watch way that like something like The Office was for a younger generation. But I think a lot of people that are, have been, I think, inducted into the prestige television universe now that like TV is really just taking over so much of like the, I feel like the media sphere versus movies, like they're, I think, now going back and starting to watch Sopranos. So it's for sure getting, it's its own little mini revival.
Yeah. I'm excited for it. I think HBO Max should probably be pretty excited for it, cause I know HBO Max, like Warner, like they're looking for some of these bigger things that, that can really pull people there. And now you have a tie into a series that I think should be a pretty big win for them. Next up, Star Wars Vision, something that I think the three of us fairly excited about, the two of you especially. I recently have watched more and more anime. It's become something I've enjoyed quite a bit. And obviously Star Wars lends to that a lot. I'll read two quotes. This is one from Kathleen Kennedy, and we'll explain what it is if you don't know what Star Wars Visions is. It's coming out in September on Disney Plus. Star Wars Visions will be a series of animated short films celebrating the Star Wars galaxy through the lens of the world's best anime creators. Anthology collection will bring 10 visions from several of the leading Japanese anime studios, offering a fresh and diverse cultural perspective to Star Wars. So yeah, it's creative, different takes on Star, like very different takes. They had their first trailer released. Definitely take a look at it. I'll read you some of the titles. The Duel, La Pinocho, Tatooine Rhapsody, The Twins, The Elder, The Village Bride, Akakiri, T-O-B-1, and then The Ninth Jedi. Those are the titles. Star Wars has had, even like before, maybe not anime influence, but Japanese influence big time. Seven Samurai, insanely influential for George Lucas with Star Wars, like beyond just like lightsaber duel and all that. So there's so much Japanese influence already, just alone through Kurosawa and Seven Samurai, that like it really is one of the more no shit type things for Star Wars to do, to have an anime type thing. It also, watching this, it's one of those moments that we've talked about since literally the first fucking time we've done this podcast. Mm-hmm. It's allowing Star Wars to grow and expand in different ways and not be so boxed in to just like the same and the norm and this like the same old bullshit over and over again. As such big Star Wars fans, that's cool to see. It's like, why not? You have such an expansive universe of characters and so many different creative ways you can take this. Yeah, and while we love it, and I have my fucking office at home lined with the same characters over and over again, literal a four-armed chef with Dexter Jexter action figure, this is the type of thing I want to see. Whether this is good or bad, it's at least like expand it and do something different and use your creative world in a way that you're like, oh, let's reinvent the wheel a little bit here and there, because we have the ability to do so. So I liked what we saw so far. It's not as much a trailer. It was like a kind of behind the scenes type thing, but I was in before and I'm just still in, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the biggest comp I thought of was Halo Legends, which is something to do with Halo. Probably 10 years ago now, I don't really know. But they did they brought in a bunch of Japanese animation houses and had them make all these different animated versions of Halo using anime just styles and CGI, whatever. And it was really cool. It was really interesting. It was that I think less of a natural marriage to Halo and anime than obviously, like you're saying, Star Wars and anime is. So with all the influence that George Lucas took from Japanese just media in general. So it is. It's very cool. Very excited to watch this. I think that there's a very expansive universe out for them to look at. And I think especially with Star Wars is maybe more proof positive than any other media franchise that you can expand into the animated space and you can make a whole fucking different universe, like with Bad Batch and like with Star Wars, the Clone Wars, and like it makes something that's even better than the live action properties. So very natural marriage for them.
Yeah. Do you remember the Animatrix?
Yeah. So Animatrix is awesome too. That's another great point.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. That one came out, 2003. So I think I can't remember if it came out, but it probably came out after Reloaded and before Revolutions. I don't know, but I really liked what the Animatrix did for the world building. Outside of the main story in the Matrix, I thought that was super cool, and I think shorts are a really good format to be able to do that. And that I think that serves Star Wars really well in terms of just showing you something, but not necessarily having to get a full three movie arc out of it or nine movie arc or or stay on the same thing like we've been doing. And I think it's also pretty natural. I mean, you mentioned earlier, I think Star Wars is based on a lot of the same influences that anime has been off of. And therefore, I think there's a lot of similarities. Like Star Wars does, feels very similar in terms of plot and characters to some anime. Not exactly the same, obviously, but I think there's a lot of natural connectors there.
Yeah, what is called The Matrix was based off of anime, basically. The Ghost in the Shell was like the Wachowskis admitted like a trillion times. Like, we basically took the entire thing from Ghost in the Shell. And that's one of the best animes ever made.
I think what you just said, the word you said, Troll, it's natural. That's, I think, the big thing, too, is that, like, I think maybe forcing it wouldn't necessarily be like the best thing in the world. It could work, absolutely could work. But the fact that it's a natural thing that they can do because it just fits so perfectly, that's where you're excited. It's like, it's not, it doesn't even feel as much of like an experiment. Like, it's just there. It just works. Whether the actual stories and episodes are good or not, I think that would be more about the actual storytelling and content rather than like, did it work as an anime thing? Cause I think you're right. Like, naturally, like, it just kind of makes sense. So comes out in the fall. Very excited for now, September, actually the day after day fall starts. Episode brought to you in part by NordVPN, folks. We talked about NordVPN a ton. I imagine a bunch of you have NordVPN, actually. Big time Swiss Army knife for your computer. Fastest VPN in the world for sure. No sacrificing internet speed for better security. Cause if you've used VPN that isn't NordVPN, you probably ran into somewhere you connect and then you're all set up and then you're down in like half a megabyte clip. Your internet traffic routed through pretty secure encrypted tunnel, which protects your data and privacy. And NordVPN going to up that. NordVPN will allow 6 devices to run the program. You can access content from over 59 different countries by changing your virtual location with one click. And that's a big thing. That's why they're a great sponsor to have for us, because you're maybe somebody who doesn't like the geo restrictions, right? Like Netflix or local blackouts or sporting events on the area. Not an issue. Blackouts or sporting events online, especially the like MLB. Oh, the worst. The fucking one of the dumbest things of all time. Especially in the era of like cord cutting. So you can get those geo restrictions out of there. We also know Netflix in other countries has more titles. Great way to access those titles, because American Netflix doesn't have a bunch of that stuff. So when you're traveling to, whether airport, maybe restaurant Wi-Fi, hotel stuff, you don't want to be on that public Wi-Fi to begin with. So that'll help you out. Don't have anything hacked or stolen. NordVPN will protect you on your phone, laptop, all that from hackers. Give you some peace of mind. And again, the added bonus of you can access more content on some of these things that you do, whether it be your streaming services for movies, shows, or sporting events. 30-day money-back guaranteed if NordVPN is not for you, but I'm telling you it will be. NordVPN.com/LCB or use code LCB. 2-year plan plus a bonus gift, excuse me, a huge discount. NordVPN, NordVPN.com/LCB. Use code LCB. NordVPN is fantastic. I've been using it for a long, 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 long time. Very useful. Next up, more trailers. This one, not as well known. A couple of these are not as well known trailers or think properties that we've talked about a bunch, like Star Wars Visions or Many Saints in Newark, for example. One of them being Beckett, coming out on Netflix August 13th. While vacationing in Greece, Beckett, played by John David Washington, an American tourist, becomes the target of a manhunt after a devastating accident, forced to run for his life, and desperate to reach the U.S. Embassy in Athens to clear his name. Tensions escalate as the authorities close in, political unrest mounts, and Beckett falls even deeper into a dangerous web of conspiracy. John David Washington, Boyd Holbrook, Vicky Krieps, and Alicia Vikander are in the movie. I don't know about this one. I like John David Washington a lot. I think this is a case of a bad trailer. I thought this was a poor trailer.
Yeah, I feel like they didn't really give us a lot, at least not to work with. Of like, I feel like if you have someone like John David Washington and you have an interesting plot, you need to make those two things front and center. I feel like they edited this a little bit strange, if that makes sense. Like, it didn't feel like it was like a cohesive trailer.
It's, you know, those trailers where you watch them and you're like, this feels like a trailer that doesn't have an actual movie. Like, this is like a fan made, like somebody wanted to make a cool thing, so they made a trailer for a movie that doesn't exist. Like, that's what it felt like.
Like they took clips from other movies.
Yeah.
Yes. That's what it did. Honestly, I was like, it's just a weird trailer.
They just like 90% of the movie is from the Christopher Nolan Batman, or 90% of the trailer is from the Christopher Nolan Batman movie, and the other 10% is from like Tenet.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
It's like, I'm sure this could be good. Like, we love John David Washington. I mean, we've interviewed Boyd Holbrook, Alicia Vikander, but there's not a lot here. And but it's like the weird, it's that weird trailer combo of not a lot there, but it feels like it's for a movie that doesn't exist. Like, it's like a film class project to make a cool trailer.
I feel like all we really saw was a John David Washington check, and then the fact that they were in Greece. Those are the only two things I feel like I learned from that trailer.
You know, John David Washington is just like walking and having the conversation with, was it the Priya character and Tenet, and they're just like having that long conversation, but they're splicing that conversation in with like Alicia Vikander as Laura Croft.
Yes.
Like, fan trailer. I'll give it the benefit of the doubt, because it's on Netflix. It feels like a lot of the other Netflix movies where it's just like, here's something that looks like 75%. It's like not horrible, but it's not like anything that you're like super excited for. It's just like, you know, when you're like laying in bed and you see a pop up like now available to stream, you're like, oh, okay, I'll check that out. And that's fine. I think that's okay. I mean, that's pretty interesting, but I don't know what to think after the trailer. I don't think the trailer did, like you guys were saying, it wasn't necessarily a bad trailer, but I don't think it did a good job of selling the movie in terms of being like, you should check Beckett out.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
I'm never going to be out on a first trailer. Like, I'm never going to be out on that. However, tough when the first trailer is just kind of weird. Like, it's weird. Just, it was just strange. I don't know. I didn't, and I think some of the comments were like that as well. They were like, not sure what's going on here. But John Nib Washington, you know, give it a chance. Got a bunch of people in it. That comes out later on in August. Next up, trailer for Cinderella. Not associated with Disney. This is not like the Disney Cinderella, not live action. Obviously, Cinderella is a, it's a, whatchamacallit?
Brothers Grimm? Is it a Brothers Grimm fairy tale?
What is it? It's a fucking, what am I saying here? It's Cinderella is a, come on.
Like fair use?
Fair use, yeah, right?
Yeah, I mean, it has to be common, so I don't know what the fuck they call it. But yeah,
you know what I mean.
It's
anyway,
old ass story.
Camila Cabello, who's now a solo artist, but was in, I'm just forgetting literally everything in the world. Fifth Harmony, they won that. They won X Factor, I think, or they were formed on X Factor. Massive pop star. Billy Porter, Idina Menzel, Pierce Brosnan's in the movie. Minnie Driver, John Mulaney. I'll get to the other name in a second. Missy Elliott. And of course, we've talked about this movie before because we talked about one person in it in particular, James Corden.
Mm-hmm. Because of course.
He will be playing.
Hello, I'm a mouse.
A mouse along with John Mulaney. That's all. This looks fine. Camila Cabello's got an incredible voice. It's a musical movie. Idina Menzel's in it, which I feel like if you just told somebody it's Cinderella, Idina Menzel's in it, they go, oh, it's a musical movie. So that's what we're getting. So it could be wonderful. It's an Amazon movie. Also looked like an Amazon movie. If you watched this trailer and you didn't know what service it was on, you would have immediately, you like watch enough streaming stuff, you would have immediately guessed Amazon. Like, it just looks like an Amazon Studios movie. But the James Corden thing, I just can't get past it.
Actually, I think that's perfect. Those are the types of things we like to see James Corden in, right? He's not the guy, but he's just playing a secondary character. It's entertaining.
Like Mustafer.
I'm just thinking of like what was the one we watched where they were
Broadway the AI.
Stars. Oh, no, yeah, that was
that
weird.
Stunk. Yeah.
You
think of Prom Night, I think what it was called.
Yeah. I'm kind of excited about this one because Kay Cannon's directing it. And is she writing it? She's writing it. And she wrote all three Pitch Perfect movies or was on the writing team to do that. She directed Blockers and she was a writer for 30 Rock and New Girl, which are all fantastic things. I think if they lean into the comedy elements of this, I think it could be pretty entertaining. I actually think this is going to be more entertaining than the Disney Cinderella film released like 6 years ago.
I don't know. Like, I'm not like overly enthused or over the moon about wanting to go watch anything Cinderella involved where I'm like, damn, that's such a story I just need to see more of. But a lot of that cast is incredibly talented. Like you were saying before, I mean, Camila Cabello, incredible voice, dating. Who's she dating? She's dating Shawn Mendes, right?
Yes.
Bizarrely talented,
fucking fantastic voice.
Bizarrely talented couple there. But yeah, the great voice cast, great acting cast. That the Amazon aspect is just a little strange, just because I think even if it's not, I just associate Cinderella so much with Disney. Whether that's fair or not, but I don't know. I'm not like over the moon to watch it, but it's super super talented cast. So I'll always give anything like that a chance.
That's what Disney wants you to do, man.
Exactly.
They want you to stay away from these other productions of these public domain.
They want to sign up.
Yeah, I look
public domain. There.
What's that?
Sorry. The brain fart. That was.
I like brain farts.
Good wet one.
I'm not the biggest. Like, what's the best adaptation of Cinderella of all time? I can't, and well, nothing comes to mind. Cinderella is one of those.
This is actually, you know, this is the second James Corden thing involving Cinderella, right?
Was he in Enchanted?
He was in Into the Woods.
Into the Woods. Mm. Was Enchanted a Cinderella thing, or was that just supposed to be like a Cinderella proxy character?
Yeah, like an homage. Was there actually, they're coming out with Enchanted 2.
Hmm.
Let's see. Oh, a Cinderella story with Hilary Duff and Chad Michael Murray.
Was Anne Hathaway in a Cinderella movie?
Ellen.
She was in she was in Princess Diaries.
I mean, that's basically, well, that's not really Cinderella.
Yeah, there was, she got like people who gave her shit, but she didn't have like a
any stepmother and all that. I hereby declare any movie involving princesses is now in the Cinderella genre of movies.
The Durellaverse.
The Durellaverse.
Jason Durella.
Also, speaking of verses and movie universes, it's like somebody didn't realize that the cap was on the Vin Diesel family gifts for Fast and the Furious.
They're oh my god, dude!
Memes everywhere. Every meme is a Vin Diesel family meme right now, and some of them are admittedly very like it's such a simple joke and it's been made for years. But all of a sudden, every meme is a Vin Diesel family meme.
I think it's a Fast and Furious plant. That was a Universal plant. They want people to share those. It's just free advertising for them. Because like no one looks at one of these Vin Diesel memes and thinks like, oh, well, yeah, I'm not going to watch Fast and Furious anymore. It's the opposite. I'm like, damn, now I want to go watch Fast and Furious because I want to see Dom Toretto doing the family thing.
Ella Enchanted.
Mm-hmm.
Anne Hathaway was in that. Is that Cinderella or is that just Ella?
Ella Enchanted is Cinderella.
Who knows? I'm not here to argue.
Ella Enchanted.
The Durellaverse.
Another Cinderellaverse.
That's Cinderella. One more trailer, and this one is very interesting. I don't know really what my take is on this yet, but I'm not sure I love it. So Don't Breathe 2. Don't Breathe was an awesome horror movie. Awesome horror movie from 2016, one of the more underrated movies. And it's tough to call something underrated anymore. Like, cause now we're like 5 years down the line. And I think enough people have seen it and they've like realized that it's a very solid horror movie, but now there's a sequel. And I don't really know how to feel about it.
It seems like they're trying to redeem the rapist kidnapper guy, which is very strange.
I don't want to judge it based off a trailer, but here we go. In Don't Breathe, Norman Nordstrom, played by Stephen Lang, was underestimated by everyone because of his blindness. He revealed an unflinching will to survive and get what he wants, but also a monstrous evil side of his personality, as nothing, no person or conscience will stand in his way. I feel like that's burying a little bit. The guy was terrible. Now in Don't Breathe 2, 8 years later, Nordstrom lives with 11-year-old Phoenix. He has recreated the family that was stolen from him by a drunk driver and has found the twisted justice he's always felt was his due. When intruders once again come to his home, this time focused on Phoenix, Norman will reveal for a second time what's hidden inside him. And again, it will be in new and unexpected ways. It's weird. It's weird because you have two ways to do this, right? Three. You run it back. He's the bad guy. But that's you're really going to run it back like that? Two, you do a whole new cast crew. You do basically like we're going to talk Knives Out 2 in a second. You do like a Knives Out 2 type thing, a whole brand new thing. Or you give him a redemptive arc. I don't know if they're maybe this is like a bait and switch, right? But we can only really work with what we're being given right now. And it sure does seem like a redemptive arc in a sense. Like maybe they're going to reveal more demons, but even the way it's just weird, right? Like I don't really have another way to describe it. It's definitely not what I expected, but it seems like they went with the redemptive arc. Maybe there's a twist. I don't know. He's a bad dude.
I feel like the trailer reaction has been like kind of the same as our reaction. I think is pretty common. Most people are like, how can you try to redeem a character like this? The kidnapper racist man. It's not somebody you want to view in the light. So either there's two things that happen here. One, either they are doing this and it's extremely, extremely stupid, or two, they're not doing this. And whoever edited this trailer did a really just horrifically bad job because everyone is getting that same sort of reaction or that same vibe from this trailer. So I don't know. Either way, bad for them and kind of bad for the original movie, too, because, again, like you were saying before, I think that Don't Breathe, the original, is one that people look on more and more as being one of the better horror movies, probably the last like 5-ish years, because it is. It's really, really good. Like, I think I don't remember if we reviewed it or not. I remember we talk about it a lot just because like that was one of those movies that really just made fantastic use of sound and of like not using sound too, which is something that is always,
right.
I think we point out as being really, really cool and when it's done well.
Well, the first one ended with them getting on the train, right? The two leads.
The two mains. Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
So you kind of left it open for them, but you're not bringing them back.
Well, like that part, if that's whatever, like the not using them. Like I understand why you're going to do a new story, but like the, if you're going to keep him, which you got, you kind of have to, like you can't redeem the Stephen Lang character. I forget what his name was off the top of my head, but you just can't redeem him. Can't do it.
It's just, I don't know. Again, we just talked about this with Beckett. Like, I don't really want to judge a movie based on one trailer, but this one is a little different, like the Beckett thing. I'm less talking about quality and more story decision. It's just odd. And we, there's a bunch of people who've said that, like, huh? This is what we're going with. And then last bit of news, and I just mentioned Knives Out 2. Knives Out 2, Ethan Hawke added to the cast. There is one more trailer. There's a whole other trailer. Ethan Hawke added Knives Out 2. That sounds great. Whatever. Just keep fucking adding people. I don't give a shit. Just like, I feel like everybody wants to be in this movie. That's a nice little thing that Rian Johnson has.
You just have to show up in Santorini or wherever they're filming. And just be like, hey.
You think anyone would try to like dupe them? It's like, hey, are you? Did I cast you? Yeah.
You know what? Okay.
Great. Sure. There you go. Clifford the Big Red Dog movie got its first trailer.
Not big enough. Clifford's just not big enough. I'm sorry.
People didn't
believe. Looks
like
dog shit.
Yeah.
People didn't believe this was real. As middle schooler Emily Elizabeth struggles to fit in at home and at school, this is far too long of a synopsis for Clifford. But anyway, she discovers a small red puppy who is destined to become her best friend from a magical animal rescuer. Played by John Cleese, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't believe that.
Him showing up was a huge shock.
Stunned. When Clifford becomes a gigantic red dog in her New York City apartment and attracts the attention of a genetics company, which it just sounds funny.
It's the Jurassic Park tent where they're like, we gotta weaponize this big red dog.
Mm-hmm.
They have to fight the forces of greed as they go on the run across New York City and take a bite out of the Big Apple. Clifford affects the lives of everyone around him and teaches Emily and her uncle the true meaning. Look, it looks like a very nice, like, lovely kids movie. Like, that synopsis makes it seem far more serious than this movie really is. It's a kids movie. You had the classic replies to this from people like who's this for? Kids.
Kids.
Mm-hmm.
Who has kids? It looks like a delightful, but I will say this. There's a point in this trailer where Clifford runs into one of those, like, those Zorbs, you know, like those balls that you go in and people roll you around a park.
Yeah.
He kills that person.
Yeah, that guy died.
He kills that guy. That guy dies. Like, I mean, like, let's call a spade a spade. He pushes that ball 100 yards across Central Park and slams it into a tree. That guy's dead.
Well, Clifford just eats a baby in the Clifford movie. We did a little heel turn out of this. Because that would be terrifying. You do a Cujo angle.
He eats a dog.
The big red dog.
He spits the dog back out, but he eats the dog briefly.
Would have swallowed him.
I don't remember Clifford that well, but I never remember Clifford in the city environment. I always thought Clifford just had a big house and he had
suburb
a big dog
guy.
House. He's a suburb dog. Now
I thought of Clifford as a.
You thought Clifford was a city dog? Secret Life of Pets 3?
Slop 3.
When was John Cleese's last major non-animated
voice
role?
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like he does voice stuff a lot.
The Croods, Planes, Trolls, Arctic Dog. When the fuck was his last?
He's just been chilling. Like, I follow him on Twitter. He just like hangs out in Miami and just makes random videos.
The Pink
Panther 2?
He was
like 90. That makes sense.
12 years ago? God, that's crazy. I couldn't believe it. What do you think of when you think of Clifford, though? What's the one thing that comes to your mind?
The big red dog, usually.
Yeah, the big red
Clifford.
When
you think of literally Clifford the big red dog.
How big and red he is.
Yeah.
That is true. That was one of Scholastic's like top tier properties, wasn't it?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Clifford was kind of always like the mascot for those. Like you'd get your money that you may have or like your few bucks, and then like your parents want you to buy a book, but you'd walk with like a Clifford toy or some bull. Like Clifford was always like the main character of the Scholastic book fair.
Either always have the ad. It would be like the Scholastic red tag when it was next to Clifford, the big red dog, right up next to it.
Right.
Although he looked like a regular sized dog because there was nothing else relative to show his size. Big mistake by the advertisers. Maybe Clifford's hair is actually white and the red is the blood of the people he eats. See, there's a new arc for Clifford.
It's like a flamingo, right?
Exactly.
That's
dark,
dude.
That's what I'm saying. That would be interested in that.
I do think they nailed the Clifford font that's on the books.
Yes. That was tough to do as well.
Because every time I see that font, the Clifford font, and I'm seeing like a book cover, it's the same thing with the Berenstain Bears or whatever you want to call it, where it immediately takes me back. There's something very appealing about the Clifford books, as I remember to a kid, just from my experience, because I really like them. The concept of a big red dog is very cool. I think kids are really going to enjoy this movie. We can complain about it as much as we can. It is kind of funny to see it in, you know, to see it being put into a movie like this and then have the CGI happen. And then, you know, think back to the book where I remember Clifford being a lot bigger than this dog, but you know, whatever. I'm not here to argue.
Yeah. No, I mean, I have like no issue with this movie whatsoever. Like we're not going to review this in the podcast.
We should absolutely be the podcast that gatekeeps Clifford the Big Red Dog. That should be our thing.
Cinema Sins, 21 things wrong about Clifford. Yes, the Big yes, Red Dog. Yes.
This podcaster destroys Clifford trailer.
I don't dislike Cinema Sins though. Over the I just don't watch it anymore. I think it lost kind of like the fun. It just got, I think, a little too like, it just got like, remember they used to be like 5 minute videos. Now they're like sometimes 2-part 20 minute videos.
Yeah.
There had to be a moment where that guy, like he was like, fuck me, this has gotten too far. These are too many sins. Simply too many sins.
Well, I thought it was fun because like I always thought it was tongue in cheek at first, but then like I saw people like linking Cinema Sin, like it was really like the Last Jedi type era where everybody was getting mad about movies all the time, and there's just people would like link Cinema Sin's videos as like actual reasons like why the movie wasn't good, which I you know, say what you want, but like I think Red Letter Media does that with actual nuance and comedy. Correct. like their yes. ability to talk about like the Phantom Menace and like the, you know, structure of it is a better takedown than like they didn't have someone in this screen for 15 seconds and then they pop back up. Like, what, that's just for fun. But then people started being like, oh, like Rian Johnson, you see this video or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just like, again, I've no, like, and he kills it and he makes a lot of fun, like they make a shitload of money, I'm sure. But I just like, there had to be a point where it's like, oh fuck,
I gotta do this for every movie now.
This dude thinks he's like Constantine. He's just roaming around like sending all of these sin demon movies back to hell. He'd excise them.
So many sins.
Cinema Sins for the Tomorrow World, or the World Cup isn't played in the winter. Oh shit.
Damn it.
It actually is next year. Damn it. I'm an idiot.
Malcolm D. Lee, director of a bunch of stuff. We also got to talk Undercover Brother, which was awesome. Getting to hear him like give a really nice take on like why that movie worked and thoughts on why that movie worked for him. But also talk about Space Jam and the difficulties of that and having to deal with expectations. Malcolm D. Lee was awesome. Here's our interview with him. All right, we are joined now. We were actually just talking a little basketball before this started. The irony. Mm-hmm. Malcolm D. Lee, director, Space Jam, A New Legacy, and other things that we are going to talk about as well. But Space Jam, not Space Jam 2, but it basically is Space Jam 2. It's coming back. LeBron James this time. Look, this is one of those movies. It's not like I really have to explain what it is. I think people know what's happening, what's coming out. July 16th on HBO Max or in theaters as well. You can go see it either way you want. Though I would say, we've been saying it for weeks, you can get to a theater, go to a theater.
Mm-hmm.
Go to a theater. How are you? How's it going? This is a pretty look. You released some big movies, but this one is kind of, this has to be a whole different weird ball of wax, right?
It is a big ball of wax. I mean, look, you know, 2 years on a movie. I've never done that, you know. So yeah, it's a big thing. I'm very proud of the end result. It took a long time to get there, but you know, I think the movie is very, very cool. Probably the coolest movie in my canon. And, you know, I definitely a movie that's built for the theatrical experience.
Yeah, the hype is the big thing. I've read a couple of interviews that you've talked about it already. Like, it's not, there's just no, and you even mentioned too, you're like, even the LeBron haters are going to go see it. Like, there's really no easy way to do anything that's a follow-up. And then you're bringing in, like, the basketball world where you're either loved or hated when you're a superstar. How, like, what was that first moment for you? Cause you also, and we'll talk about this. You also obviously joined this process a little later on in the game. what was like, was there a moment for you to be like, okay, this is different. Not everyone's going to be appeased. Like, it's nostalgia. When you're dealing with nostalgia, it can't be easy. Did you have that moment of like clarity?
I really, you know, it's funny. I didn't have that moment of that about nostalgia and all that until like, to be quite honest, not until the Entertainment Weekly article came out. I couldn't be focused on that, you know. Yeah. Like, I had to make, you know, the movie and deal with what, you know, how I wanted to make this movie and what the studio was looking to make and what LeBron was wanting to make. So that was, you know, being true and authentic to the Looney Tunes characters and, you know, telling the story of this father and son. So, you know, it's not until, you know, you start seeing people on the internet being mad about Lola Bunny not having boobs, you know, that you're just kind of like, what's going on here? Like, I didn't realize, I mean, look, we're trying to make a movie for kids primarily. So let's focus on that and not focus on, just because I said, you know, we want to focus on strong female characters doesn't mean that we say, oh, you know, women can't be strong if they have big boobs. Sure, women can be strong if they have big boobs. Not a problem. But I mean, we're talking about a cartoon bunny. So yeah, it wasn't until, you know, the article, I was kind of like, boy, this is the people, they take this very, very seriously and very personally. So, you know, like, you know, look, I want to do was make a great movie. And I think we were able to achieve that and still, and hopefully, you know, the people who love Space Jam will love the original Space Jam will love this too.
What do you think the balance was like for not even just you, but the writers for the studio, as far as who you guys were trying to target? Were you trying to target more of the nostalgia head? Were you trying to target more of the new audience, or a combination really of both?
I think it's a combo. You know, you always think of this movie as a four quadrant movie. So, you know, you want to get men, women, boys, girls, and, you know, and across all races, ethnicities and religions, you know, it should be that kind of movie. It's a family film. So I don't think, you know, I think that was the target, you know, like, you know, I assume that, you know, people who love the Looney Tunes are going to love this, and people who loved, you know, the original Space Jam will love this as well. We try to make the movie just as satisfying, if not more so, if we could, you know, because of the technology, because of, you know, what we're able to do and the kind of, and the depth that we're trying to reach, particularly with, you know, the complexity of family movies nowadays, even like your big spectacle, like Marvel and things like that and Star Wars, you know, there's a level of emotion that is not just fun and games, not just, you know, great spectacle, but you want to feel something also when you're watching a movie, you know, otherwise why would they, you know, let Iron Man die? Why would they, you know, make us feel, you know, on the edge of our seat when the Toy Story character is about to get incinerated in Toy Story 3, you know, you feeling something there. And so, like, you know, we were trying to, you know, capture, you know, a range of emotions, of course you want to get laughter, but you also want, you know, your audience to feel something as well.
What, and the challenge for you too, again, we mentioned, we don't have to get too far into it because obviously production, I'm sure you can get bogged down, but you joined the process late. And like, that had to be a fairly different little hurdle for you as well. Was that like, did you join in and it's like, because I know like there were some rewrites like Ryan Coogler, but like, oh, there's a lot involved there. That had to be a very different thing for your career. Like, did that kind of,
it was very different. Road? It was very different. A, you know, because I'd never done a movie with this level of visual effects and never done a movie with any animation before. So if you're talking about like, you know, credits have a little bit of your credits have animation on them, but like nothing up to this level. Right. So yeah, I mean, like, that was daunting. But I think the culmination of my 20 year career allowed me and prepared me for that moment to step into the movie at that particular time. And yeah, there wasn't a whole lot of time. You talk about a little hurdle. It was a huge hurdle to get over, just for the amount of preparation that I was allowed to have. It wasn't a lot, you know. I was preparing and shooting and learning and developing at the same time. It was all happening at once, you know. And so that wasn't easy, but thankfully I had, you know, great professionals you know, in the animation team at WAG, Warner Animation Group, and the ILM team in Industrial Light and Magic, you know, that were top notch, you know, at their profession, and allowed me to see like, oh, these are just tools in a toolbox to tell a story and to use, you know, in cinematically. And so, you know, once you understand that, it becomes easier and less daunting of a task to do your job as a director.
Was there any hesitation for you? Because I feel like even taking this on from scratch, I imagine, would have been quite the pond. It's like, oh, Space Jam. But to do it when it's already so far down the road, did you have a moment where you went, ah, maybe I don't do this?
Well, it's funny because, you know, my representatives years ago were saying, you know, you should really engage on Space Jam. And I was like, I'm a basketball purist. I don't know. I have a basketball movie that I want to tell. I don't know that I want to do it with Bugs Bunny, you know, right. So when it came time, there was no time to think, you know? And so you're, you know, whatever insecurities or shortcomings you think you have as a director, other people see it in you. And they're like, well, you got to do that. They're offering that to you. You've got to do it. So I'm like, well, I remember I told my wife, I was like, hey, they want me to do Space Jam. She was like, well, I hope you said yes, you know? And I was like, I guess, you know? And then, you know, you start to think about it. And you know, I asked a few people before I took the job on, most notably Ron Howard. I called him up because, you know, he took over for Solo. Yeah. And I was like, well, what was the thought process there, Ron? Like, how did you come to that decision? And after talking to him and, you know, feeling like Ron and I are kind of, you know, in a similar mindset when it comes to filmmaking and whatnot, I was like, oh, well, that makes sense. And so, you know, I said, okay, well, I'm going to take it on. And plus, you know, the studio was very supportive of me, you know, doing it. Obviously, the producers were as well.
So I think we were lucky enough to see a screener of this movie. And one thing I really noticed about it was that the kids that played the alter ego James children were fantastic actors. They were all amazing. But it made me think, did any of LeBron's kids audition? Did they actually want the roles as their alter ego selves?
You know what? I don't even know. That was before my time. You know, I doubt it. I doubt they wanted that because I think, you know, LeBron had to be a little bit different than just himself. I mean, yes, it's a certain persona that you have already, but he had to be a little bit, you know, more of a drill sergeant in the beginning about, you know, and about basketball and about what he wanted for his children. And I think that's the role that you take on as any parent. You want your kids to kind of be molded in your image. And so, you know, I think, you know, for him to, you know, have one of his other kids in there, his real kids in there, I think it would have been much more difficult, believe it or not, for him to play himself, you know, rather than playing a version of himself with a kid that wasn't his actor. The kid that wasn't his child.
Gotcha. You mentioned before how LeBron has really great depth comedy wise, and I agree. I remember in Trainwreck, I was so pleasantly surprised watching him in that because he was so funny. Do you think that he can bring it from a dramatic standpoint as well?
You know, I think that was what was I don't know if I call it surprising, but I certainly was pleased to know that he could get to some emotional depths as well, you know. And so, you know, there's that final speech that he gives, you know, or talk that he gives with his son where they're reconciling. And, you know, I think he reached a level that of emotion that I don't think people are going to expect. So, you know, I feel like it's I think like any actor, he has to do the work, right? You know, you have to be prepared for it and be open and listen to direction. And he's that kind of person anyway, you know, as much as people say, oh, LeBron's coaching himself. He likes to be coached, you know, he likes that people say, okay, you know, as much as he is a student of the game that he is, and how astute he is about what's happening, you know, on the court. The people that are outside of it, you know, whether it's, you know, Anthony Davis or Vogel or whoever, they're seeing some other things like, hey, keep an eye on this. And so, of course, he's going to absorb all that as well and do that to the best of his ability.
You mentioned too, about even just like his kids are in the movie, and you have like, they're not, his kids are not in the movie, but like his kids are in the movie. He has like a mansion, all this. Do you remember, and I'm sure you've watched enough of Space Jam, I don't know, maybe you didn't along the way, Michael Jordan's house in the first one? It was very much not Michael Jordan's house, which I think at the time people knew Michael Jordan was a pretty famous athlete. He had a TV. Right. He had a TV on like a, he had like a TV, like the, like a 12 inch TV in like a nightstand in his living room. Yeah. And you're like, man, I don't think Michael Jordan was watching TV that small. I just want to, I'm just, thank God we got LeBron in like a mansion in this movie.
Yes.
It's just, I'm glad we did.
Yeah. No, it made a lot of sense. I think, you know, but I think, you know, the what they were depicting in, at least from my view of it, what they were depicting in the first Space Jam was like his house that he was staying at when he was doing minor leagues, you know, for the Birmingham Barons. So that's how I took that, you know.
Okay, sure, that's okay. Yeah.
Like, yo, Dad, you could do a little bit better than this. but we had a great production design team that you know, let us show the opulence of, you know, how LeBron, an athlete like LeBron James, is living. Plus, we see it now. You know, I think back in the 90s, you know, you had MTV Cribs, but you didn't really like, you know the behind the scenes, you know, lifestyles of how people are living. So I think that was, something that we had to have. You know, we couldn't just put, you know, LeBron in some kind of like rinky dink type of spot.
another thing from that movie, a rumor that has gone around for years. It's not true, but for years, people thought that Eric Gordon, NBA star Eric Gordon, played Michael's kid in the movie Space Jam. That's like one of those classic, just ran wild internet stories. Not true.
Okay.
So I think you need to start thinking about a rumor you can make with this movie.
Yeah.
So years from now, people think that something was in this movie.
People, I'm gonna think about that one. That's kind of crazy. Eric Gordon.
All you need is one friend with a Twitter account to tweet it out in like 2 years, be like, oh, did you know so and so was actually that was the guy in Space Jam in the corner. That was him.
That's interesting. I'm sure I could come up with something. You know, we have a lot of extras and stuff like that in the movie too. So it's you never know.
I got an idea for you, and this is just I'll float it out there. You say the actor who played Dom, Cedric Joe. You say it's not actually him. You say it was a digitally de-aged Muggsy Bogues. How about that?
Hey, a digitally de-aged Muggsy Bogues. I think Cedric Joe's a little bit taller than Muggsy. That may not fly. Well, by the way, Cedric grew like 4 inches over that summer.
That's so,
oh my gosh!
It was crazy. It was crazy because, you know, he was aging by the second, and his voice got deeper. And we're like, oh boy, this is not a kid anymore. So we're gonna have to change some things here.
That's a tough wrinkle to get through. That's one of those wrinkles in Hollywood that I don't think you can really do much about, unfortunately.
Yeah, it was a little bit tough, but we got through.
He's turning it into a Linklater movie.
Hey, there you go, Boyhood.
out July 16th, HBO Max theaters. I'm gonna talk about some of the other stuff too before we go here. Movie you did a long time ago. I actually see the post in the background behind you.
Yeah,
I see a snippet of Undercover Brother. We've done through almost 400 episodes of this podcast. People know I love nothing more than talking about parody movies and the success and how they just can't really be made anymore. But Undercover Brother falls in that line of came out at the right time, hit all its marks. Everyone who talks about it still to this day loves it because you can just connect with it depending on who you are and just different various things.
Sure.
For you, and you've done other parody movies too. You did Scary Movie 5 and that was kind of the end of that franchise. And now like there's no chance they can make a movie like that now and think that it would connect.
Not after that version, no. They can't.
But Undercover Brother still just connects. Like, what goes into that in your eye? I asked it to anybody who's done a parody movie. What in your eyes made that work so well and still hold up?
Unfortunately, a lot of what we're talking about in Undercover Brother still rings true. I mean, you know, like it never more evident than the past 4 years. You know, like, you know, the man in that movie still talks about keeping the White House white, and you know the jokes about race and black paranoia and white supremacy is like, you know, that unfortunately they still ring true. And so like, I don't know, like back in the day, I felt like we could make a very smart subversive movie and, you know, and push the envelope. You know, I remember, you know, when we were developing the script and, you know, Mike McCullers, who was, you know, was behind a lot of Mike Myers' genius in Saturday Night Live, as well as Austin Powers, you know, pitched the idea that, you know, that the general played by Billy Dee Williams, like, you know, a Colin Powell slash Obama before Obama, you know, it was going to be not entering politics, but opening a chain of fried chicken joints, that, you know, the executives were like, oh, we can't do that. I was like, oh, we have to do that. We've got to do that. Because that you're gonna lean into the stereotype, because that's how ridiculous it is. And so, you know, I'm very proud of the movie. It was a very tough movie to do, because you know it's a studio movie with big expectations that they want to appeal to 13-year-olds, and I was trying to make something a little bit more satirical, and so trying to make, you know, meet that somewhere in the middle, and I think that, you know, it just worked, and it still works to this day.
That's a movie that I think when I was 13-year-old, it appealed to me tremendously. And I think I watched it on TV 1,000 times. So I think success from that end and a movie when I watched later on and recognized more of the satirical elements and appreciated it even more. There was one scene I remember, though, specifically marveling at, I would say, when I was a 13-year-old. And it's the mayo sandwich scene, which that scene, it makes me like my body shiver thinking about Eddie Griffin eating that mayo sandwich. And just, I needed to know, did he actually eat it? Did he swallow a bite of that disgusting sandwich?
He did. He did. Oh. He got tuna with extra mayo.
Oh, it was almost disgusting.
And by the way, it's so funny too, because like, you know, a lot of people have an issue with that mayonnaise joke, because it's like, black people love mayonnaise, you know what I mean? So like, you know, like to say that like this is like a white thing, and I, you know, and a lot of people white people I talk to are like, ew, mayonnaise. So it's like, I don't know. Like, that's a joke that kind of works. I guess depending on who you are, it kind of works. But hey, yes, he did actually take a bite of that sandwich with mayo.
Again, like it's like snails on a chalkboard. Even like watching the teeth sink into it. Oh,
and the sound of the
yep.
Yeah.
That little like, oh.
Yeah.
like Jeff mentioned before, you also did Scary Movie 5. That you got into it, I think, right as that parody era was starting to like lose its steam, I would say. And just like you were saying before, they just don't really play as much now. Do you think there's ever a chance of movies like that ever making a comeback, that parody era of movie?
I think it can. You know, I think, you know, when That's not a movie that like I like having on my resume, to tell you the truth. It was kind of a mess, really, from the top to the bottom. You know, but it's one of those things that when people talk about comedy is dead, or, you know, African American movies are a bad investment, like nothing works until it does. You know, they said romantic comedy was dead until, you know, Crazy Rich Asians made, you know, a gajillion dollars. You know what I'm saying? They were saying comedy was dead until Girls Trip broke the bank. You know what I mean? So I think, yes, if it's done the right way, people will embrace it. But it has to be done in the right way. Because, you know, lots of parody happens, even on the small screen now, though, right? Like there's imitations, you know, that are being done, you know. So I think that it can. It just has to be in the right form, and it has to catch people at the right time. So yeah, I don't think anything's ever dead. Maybe black and white movies, maybe silent movies are dead, but maybe. You never know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess The Artist did win an Oscar, so who knows?
There you go.
It's funny because we mentioned you jumping into Space Jam. You do that in the middle of a production, massive thing you're taking in there to animation. But you also you had another franchise movie, which we talk about frequently because I think it's a rather hidden gem in terms of franchise movies. That's the third Barbershop movie, mm-hmm. Barbershop, yeah. The Next Cut, which is one that is we play this Rotten Tomatoes game all the time where you appeal to like guess what Rotten Tomatoes score. And that's like that and the Babadook are the best way to trip people up. People don't realize like Barbershop, The Next Cut, it's a pretty awesome movie. And you went into that franchise. That's the third movie in a franchise. First of all, that just alone is like an impossible task. But you made something that was like fairly thought-provoking and I think deeper than you could have expected. Not that the other ones were awful, but it was kind of a weird like change of pace in like that had to be a different challenge as well, right? Like jumping into a franchise and trying to change up how it's like presented on screen.
It's so funny. Like now I've done like, you know, five movies that have like had a predecessor, you know, starting with my own with Best Man, Barbershop, you know, Scary Movie 5, Space Jam. But yeah, so like if I look at, you know, how Barbershop came, you know, to fruition, you know, when State Street guys, the producers, Rob Tidal and George Tillman approached me about it and Ice Cube, you know, I was like, well, what new information are we going to get? And I think, you know, at the time there was such a huge gun problem in Chicago. It still is, but you know, a massive gun problem in Chicago. And we wanted to shine a light on that, you know, the script that Kenya Barris and Tracy Oliver wrote, you know, I thought, had, you know, still stayed true to a lot of the, you know, the original Barbershop, you know, of the, you know, the very kind of like talky, joke, you know, environment, but also, you know, came into some real, depth in terms of what they were talking about, like social commentary that they were talking about. So I had always, you know, wanted to put my stamp on one of the Barbershop movies. You know, they had approached me about the first one when it first came out, but I was doing Undercover Brother. And so, you know, the opportunity to do, you know, to do this and to work with Ice Cube and Cedric, you know, I had worked with Cedric earlier, but you know, working with Cedric in one of his iconic roles was a great chance to, you know, to do that and also say something, you know, and you know, and you know, because it falls in the wheelhouse of the kind of movies I like to make, particularly when it comes to the tone that is set, is, you know, this kind of dramedy thing that I like to do. There's a lot of like grounded characters, can get really, really funny, but also, you know, be very serious and, you know, and tap into the emotions of people and, you know, has humor and heart. And those are the kind of movies that I like to make.
Yeah, no, we always say it. We're like, it's one of those movies that you just, anytime you hear the third movie in a franchise, like, oh boy. But
yeah, right, exactly. 100%. You know what was a good third movie, you know, in a franchise was the Lethal Weapon.
Lethal Weapon 4, not so much, but.
Yeah, true.
Would you ever do, now that you've done animation and we'll wrap up here on Space Jam, would you ever do maybe, like a, I don't know, like a Who Framed Roger, like just something different now that you've done it. We're like, all right, now let me maybe do something from scratch that can involve animation.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm no longer intimidated by it. I've had a couple of things in development that would have, you know, hybrid elements, animation and live action. So, you know, they were always kind of kicked down the field a little bit. But now that I've done it, I feel, you know, quite confident that I would be able to achieve it and understand the process. Of course, you know, you're still learning as you go on in your filmmaking career. So, you know, I still have things to learn, but yeah, I feel like I would definitely do that for sure. I mean, if a studio will pay for it, heck yeah. I mean, because, you know, a lot of times they want things that have been proven to work, you know, you know, it's before they spend hundreds of millions of dollars. They want, you know, IP that, you know, supports, you know, that there's an audience. So they're not going to spend money on just anything. So you have to prove that, you know, A, you have a bankable star, B, you know, a property that has, you know, a proven track record. And then, you know, you see what can happen. But yes, I would definitely do that.
Before we go here, I'll give you the floor, because you've mentioned, again, I've seen you talk about interviews. You know it too. It's the nostalgia heads, the old people thinking this is a movie for them, which, yeah, it is. It is to an extent. Also a kid's movie, though, but why give Space Jam a chance? Just for those out there, because you've talked about the doubters, the haters, why give this movie a chance for everyone listening?
Look, it's a great time at the movie theater, right? Like, we've all been, you know, siloed in our homes, you know, watching things on our you know, our small screens, our big screen TVs, by ourselves, with our family, with our bubbles. And here's an opportunity, you know, where the country's starting to open back up. It's a great time at the movie theater. It's fun. It's funny. It's got spectacle. It's got heart. You know, and even if you don't like LeBron, you'll like this version of LeBron. You know what I mean? And you'll certainly love the Looney Tunes characters. You know, I think, you know, with the technology that we have, where they're 2D and why they're changing to 3D, and, you know, the movie is about being yourself, as a great message for families, a great message for parents, you know, and for kids, for that matter. So I think if you decide that you hate LeBron and you don't want to see it because of him, you're missing out. That's what I would say.
Well, the version of LeBron that I like is the one that my sons bounce from the playoffs. That's my personal favorite.
The one I like, you know what? The one I like as a Cavs fan, I heard Blocked by James in the beginning of that movie. Mild spoiler. So that's all I needed to hear to be happy.
Yes, sir.
You had me off the top. thank you so much. Good luck with Space Jam. Thank you so much. Love talking.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot. Take care.
thank you.
All right. Big thank you to Malcolm Dealey, Space Jam, HBO Max as well, like many things in Newark, and in movie theaters very soon. We'll talk to him again about Hot Wheels, the movie that he's not making, apparently. Crazy.
We scooped him.
Yeah, he had no idea he was doing that movie. The Tomorrow War. The Tomorrow War.
Great name.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah.
I mean, it is very literally in the sense of this movie, the war of tomorrow, but now literally, because it not happens actually tomorrow. 20 years out. So maybe, mm-hmm. maybe shitty name. I don't know.
the 28 year later war.
This is out on Amazon Prime Video starring, Chris Pratt in the lead role. Chris McKay, the director, also did the Lego Batman movie.
Mm-hmm.
An ordinary man is recruited by time travelers from 30 years in the future to fight in a war against deadly aliens. That is your very basic synopsis. J.K. Simmons, Betty Gilpin, Sam Richardson, Theo Vaughn, a bunch of other people in this movie. Just over 2 hour movie. Ken Jack, I'll start with you. I think you kind of led that. We assumed this movie was going to be terrible, right?
Mm-hmm. No, we for sure thought it was going to be ass. I was been down on this for a while, and I think that I said probably a couple episodes ago, I was like, I'll eat my hat if this movie isn't ass. And, you know, I'm eating it. I'm eating my goddamn hat.
He's eating his hat right now.
I'm physically eating my hat because this movie was – there's many issues with it, but it is undeniably entertaining. And I think we can get into it more, but I think that there's a couple ways you could break down the movie. I think that number one – the time travel aspect isn't really explained all that great. The personal story is really dumb, and it's too long. But there's cool production value. There's great special effects, really well-designed monsters, and sneaky, very solid humor. Like, it's this weird, big amalgam of, like, The Edge of Tomorrow, Battle of Los Angeles, like, Gears of War, Transformers, Interstellar. And, like, it's just this weird mix of, like, all of those styles and all of those, like, sort of, like, adventure military sci-fi tech storyline, and the story wasn't really too well thought out, but it's just so fucking entertaining in a very dumb brain way. And like, there's just so much stuff about this where I'm like, I thought it was very fun and a very easy watch. It's just, and objectively, I cannot look at this movie and say it's anything better than a 73, which is what I gave it, which is still, again, significantly higher than what I gave it. But I think we should break it down into what we liked and didn't like, right?
Yeah, I mean, I gave it a 70. I thought it – look, I think the biggest issue with this movie is it slogs a little bit. There's a little too much meat there for what it is, because it is a – and I don't mean this in a negative – like, it's – I don't want to say a dumb movie. It's not a dumb movie, but it's just one of those movies where I think a movie being a little tighter – and again, I said all the time, you know me, I fucking love longer movies. But I think it's a movie that could have been a little tighter. Maybe.
Well, they have to explain everything. The 30% of the movie is stuff being explained, which, as an idiot myself, I very much enjoyed.
You like that? Yes. No, but I was significantly higher on this movie than I thought. I've seen a lot of comps to I'm forgetting the name of everything.
Edge of Tomorrow?
Army of the Dead.
Oh, Army of the Dead?
Okay, yeah.
People are comparing, they're like, similar lane. I still, like, I don't know. I don't like Army of the Dead better, but I think this is an incredibly entertaining movie. I actually might have liked it more had I seen it in theaters, honestly. But I and again, we'll get into it here in a second. But I
thought it was like a fun, good time, super average, but for what it was supposed to be, decent job.
Yeah, actually, the more I'm thinking about Armageddon, it was definitely better.
Yeah. So
the more I consciously think about it for 2 seconds.
So I give it a 60. It's a deeply stupid movie. But it also, that's what kind of makes it charming in a way. There are a lot of just, I don't even know if you consider them tropes, like, cause I can't explain them, but it's a brainless action movie and the characters are set up to be as such. The whole, you know, the start of the movie is set up to be as such. The exposition is set up to be as such. But at the end of the day, it had a lot of really cool, very entertaining action scenes. It didn't really do anything that you never really seen any before, but I think it did enough to at least kind of just be fun. It was fun. This was a fun movie. And that's the best thing you can say about it. And I was, like you were saying about eating your hat, like I was expecting this to be both deeply stupid and not fun. And I enjoyed watching it. It's got a lot of problems. Most notably the thing that bothered me, can I tell you guys the thing that bothered me the most of this movie? That it took like 10 points off the movie for me, and it's so unfair. The fact that they went back to a high school kid to be a volcano expert.
Do you know anyone that knows anything about volcanoes?
It bothered me so much. And they're in the past, right? They're in the present day in the sense of the movie. There are still volcano experts around, but the high school kid knows everything. But at the same time, it didn't really take points off the movie. That's kind of what you want, like, out of this sort of thing. Like, you don't want to think about it too hard. Like, that's that, like, dumb brain charm that I think is perfect for this sort of schlocky shit. And it worked. It was, like, so stupid. It worked.
You know what I think a lot of this movie hinged on was just the creature design. Like, if the aliens sucked or looked stupid, this movie would have been, like, Battle Los Angeles territory.
That's a great point.
If they're scary in this, they're very, very frightening. I love the way that they're like teeth and clicking, the noise they make, all that shit. I thought that they were awesome, and they really made this movie, I think, way better than it might have been otherwise. Because I like that part. I like the amount of production value that went into some of these stunts, the guns, I guess the costume wear and all that, because you could see a lot of that was like custom done. And I think that was all extremely cool. I feel like their version of time travel was like, their explanation of it was like maybe like tenuous at best. Like, it was very fucking stupid the way that they put that together. And the whole idea of like going back in time and get soldiers for the future war, I think, is stupid. But again, it's like, I feel like it's not a movie you watch when you're like, I need to poke holes in this. Like, it's fucking Tenet or whatever. I need to watch this air. It needs to do something crazy. It was very, I think, dumb brain action humor. And there's always going to be a place for that, at least in my heart. And I love that about it. I love Chris Pratt being not only like the best and coolest guy in the world, but he's also a soldier and a scientist and a biology teacher. And he has like futuristic hair plugs, which, because his hairline was unbelievable in this movie. It was like his hairline got pushed forward like 4 inches. I don't know how they did that other than just a wig, but it was great.
No, yeah. He was like, you know, that's like, I thought Chris Pratt was entertaining in this one. It was weird because like the acting was just a little off, specifically the acting between Dan Forrester, James Daniel Dan Forrester, and his adult daughter played by Yvonne Strahovski.
It was phenomenal, by the way. She was so good in this.
She was great in this. And we were talking like off pod. It's nice to get her in a role that I mean, she's obviously been in a lot of things, but I've seen her the most recently in Handmaid's Tale, and she does a fantastic job in that show too, but the character she plays, not a great person. So it was nice to get her in that role. The only thing that threw me off about the acting in this one was the fact that like their relationship, like it seemed very like weird. Like it almost like, I don't know, like if I like flew forward in time and met my adult, child is the word I forgot. I would be like I would want to like ask a little more questions. I'd maybe be a little more shocked, a little more emotional. But at the end of the day, this is an action movie. And I think like, you know, it did what it needed to do. And Sam Richardson was fantastic.
He was so good.
He was the standout role. Like he played that comic relief character to perfection. And he wasn't like a slapstick or anything like that. But his character was just so funny and fit in with the movie so well. There's a lot to like here, even though the whole thing is too long and does end with basically like J.K. Simmons and Chris Pratt, like tearing off their shirts and having a fist fight with an alien in Antarctica or wherever, but whatever.
Who cares? It also ends with what he says, a very dumb line towards the end of it, if I remember correctly. Like they say something like, my future was actually in front of me all along. It's like, what? what the fuck? And because that's the whole thing too. They say like the reason that his whole life went downhill is because he lost that job and like that one interview that like took 2 seconds and he just quit and just like abandoned his family after losing one job.
Yeah, there was a lot of character development that had to happen very quickly in this movie for it to move along. Most notably with I think the Chris Pratt and J.K. Simmons character, that was probably the most tropey of all the things in the movie to me, was the whole like strained action movie relationship between like a dad and a son. But it's one of those like, I don't like you, but God damn it, do I respect you sort of things. And then of course them reconciling at the end. But J.K. Simmons, shoot me that routine, bro.
He looked great. He looked like that picture when he did was working out to do Commissioner Gordon. Yeah. And he was just jacked out of his mind. This might have been filmed around that, but he looked great. Their relationship though, I feel like was a little bit cheeky, and like every single tough guy line that J.K. Simmons would say, Chris Pratt kind of gave him like what the fuck are you talking about sort of response. And I enjoyed that. And they did that a lot in this. They were kind of self-aware with some of the shit, like the more schlocky action lines. Like they would like have a self-aware response to it. Like with Sam Richardson, when he's like, look, he's like, they pulled these guys out of nowhere. This guy's wearing a chef's hat. Like that shit was just funny. I thought that was good. Well done.
The interesting thing that I saw somebody tweeted this to you and I saw you reply was, and you just mentioned it, was Battle Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
All-time trailer.
Oh, yeah.
All-time trailer. That music. Was that the music? The Sun's Gone Dark and I forget the name of the song.
And like, it is kind of like a better version, like a weird way. And I don't know if it's because like there's, and we had a couple people who, you know, post like in that Lights, Camera, Barstool, Reddit, all that stuff saying like, oh, it, you know, like maybe the jokes didn't hit. And they really, I mean, it really like the humor really wasn't like, it wasn't great humor. I think the screenplay is a massive issue here. I think there was some writing issue, like, oh, this is very clunky. Definitely dragged it down. But even an attempt at some like humor or like personality would have helped Battle Los Angeles. That movie was so fucking serious. It was just, it did not, which is funny because you watch the trailer, you're like, damn, this is crazy. And then you're like, God, there's nothing. This is lifeless. This is a dud.
Right, because this movie was serious, but it didn't like, you never got the sense that Chris Pratt wasn't like, it was worried about anything the entire time, right? Like, I felt like his character just always like had that like goofball. I mean, the scene where they're just like standing in the lab, like looking at percentages go up and down on the computer, like beep, 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 27% bonded. And they're just like having back and forth banter. And then like randomly it's like 100%. Like we got it. I mean, I think this is like one of those movies where it's like fun to talk about how stupid some of the stuff is, but it also is like, I don't want to say it's like quite money playing territory. It's not even close to that. But like, I think some of those stupid things just added to the overall charm of the movie. And maybe some things were intentional and maybe some things were not, but I can't hate it as much as I wanted.
Right. And I actually, that more aligns, you were saying more what I was trying to say, just that Battle LA it took itself too seriously. Like, I think that's the thing here. It's not the humor, that this did have an element to it that gave it a little bit of like that schlocky charm. Somebody on our Reddit posted like 20 questions in one paragraph, and I'm now going to read all of them. Said the first half was pretty good and one of the scariest blockbusters I've seen. The way they interrupted the sucking was legitimately scary for me. The second half was just plain dumb and raised many questions. Here they are. What's the point of developing the toxin when blowing up the ships works just fine? If that works, why bring people to the future to die when you can go interrupt the World Cup and tell everyone what's going on and explain why you need help and develop the toxin in our time? Why lessen the human population just to buy time for a toxin that isn't needed? Why not send your best scientists back to 2022 with your technology and knowledge and find a toxin there? Why not wait for the UN? everyone on the planet is aware of these monsters, and you have 26 years before they are first seen. There's plenty of time for the UN or the US government to figure it out. That's so much time. That's a quarter of a century, a minimum four presidents. Why, if you have to be dead to be brought to the future, aren't they bringing dead people back from like a week ago? You're born in 2025. You die in the initial attack. You get brought back the day after you die at your peak age of 23 or whatever. There are 500,000 people left on Earth, and you're telling me half of the U.S. military is still alive and not eligible for the fight somehow. And I,
all these are explained by the plot device that the jump link's not very good.
Look, they literally said that. They said it's held together by duct tape and chicken wire. What more do you want?
These are legitimate questions, but the movie waves it away by saying like,
jump link sucks. Jump link machine broke. It's as simple as that. What more explanation could you possibly want?
So then he said, look, he said, I gave it a 60. I enjoyed it. But he goes, and there's a back and forth between some people on our Reddit. My name is Awake But Very Puzzled said, yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed the movie while watching it and just ignored the logic and multiple bad Chekhov's gun lines until the entire plot collapsed by just blowing up the ship. Pratt was good, blah, blah, blah. But that is time travel movies, you're all like, it's just one of those things. And it's funny because we talked to Michael Waldron about it. And Loki is that it really is like the slightest thing you can puncture the shit out of a movie in a story when time travel is involved, which is also why Edge of Tomorrow or Live, Die, Repeat, depending on what the movie was called when you watched it, is so fucking good, is that it really... It's so airtight, and you never watch that movie and go like that. Doesn't like it. That's why Edge of Tomorrow is kind of up there in terms of any time travel stuff as kind of as good as it gets.
Mm-hmm. This movie vibe jacked the Edge of Tomorrow big time.
Yes,
the Mills sci-fi thing. Like they jacked their whole shit.
I did think the white spikes were easily killable. I was expecting them to be a little harder to kill. I guess it's a strength in numbers sort of thing, you know, where just when they're everywhere, it's probably less hard, but like, it does feel like when they get there, I don't know, they probably could have come like better equipped to that final fight.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think they could have made the white spikes without the actual spike. I think it would have been equally scary without the shooting spike thing. You know what I mean?
I don't think they highlighted the shooting spike thing enough.
Yeah, maybe too. That's it too. True.
They should have had, and I know what is it? Like, this is like a functional PG-13 rating, right? I mean, if it was R-rated, you would have someone get like a spike like through their helmet plugging into a wall and having them just hanging there, right? Like that's the sort of stuff that highlights how scary the monsters are. So maybe you got to walk that line between I don't know. I don't know what I'm trying to say other than the fact that I think the shooting thing was like very fast, which is an intent, but I could have seen them utilize it a little bit more to make the monsters a little more scary.
I think another thing they did, just speaking of the monsters really well, was like not showing us the monsters at all until the actual introduction. You know, like even when they're watching them from the Miami rooftop and like you only see in the reflection the white spikes. And they don't see it again until they're actually ready to chase them. That was really well done. I also think that that jump scene, that initial jump into Miami, was really, really cool. Like when they miss, obviously, and like all the people are falling and dying. Like that part was really just scary. And I really enjoyed that part a lot. Thought that was cool.
Yeah, that jump link's such a piece of shit.
It is a humongous piece of shit. It sucks. Why would you ever go through there?
What's the worst designed alien in these types of movies where you saw it and you were just out?
I remember the Battle of Los Angeles one kind of sucked. All I remember it had is like it had a gun in its armor and a really dumb looking head. That's all I remember about it. And like the fact that if your movie's an alien invasion movie and you have either forgettable or just like nothing aliens, that kind of sucks. Like these are, I'm going to remember these aliens because in Tomorrow War, because they're scary as shit.
I'm trying to think, like Cowboys and Aliens was pretty stupid, but that wasn't intended to be like the same thing, yeah. Right? And I'm thinking like even a good alien design, like even something like Cloverfield, which was a piece of shit movie that you couldn't see and was hyped up. Like I do think the alien was cool and threatening in Cloverfield, and we never really got that great of a look at it until the end. And even then it wasn't like that great of a look. But I'm trying to think off the top of my head, like they're all pretty similar. Like the white spikes, like at least had that look that like it was, I don't know, it kind of reminded me a little bit as like A Quiet Place, just a little less threatening, maybe.
The like speed and tentacle part of them, and the yeah, I think they had like that, those like dead shark eyes, which was really scary. I like that about them, and the teeth, like the opening wide, like super gnarly looking teeth. Those are good. Just gotta have scary aliens, and I think that carried this. It was a smart move by them.
What if they all looked like Max Rebo?
Just a planet invasion, military sci-fi movie about an invasion of Max Rebo.
And the Max There's Rebo an and the Max Rebo jizz band.
100% chance we see Max Rebo shoot a blaster at some point in the next couple of years. That's just a character. It. That's just a character that is going to do that.
The Jizz Whalers, baby. We'll be back in the Book of Boba Fett.
The Chad.
Even though traditionally he doesn't have art, it's a he's a weird character. There's a couple funny reviews. I just want to read two. I just want to read quick, like little like review snippets from Rotten Tomatoes. One that I just kind of agree with, The Tomorrow War isn't a disaster, but it could have been a lot more. I think that's a very solid, quick snippet on that. And you can kind of go one way or the other, whether you think it passes the test or not. But from the New York Magazine Vulture review, I took one look at Tomorrow War's dopey premise and knew I was all in. I love that review. That's a great snippet. My God.
Has there ever been a movie with an oil rig setting where something just hasn't gone wrong?
Dude, it was almost like you've played the Gears of War campaigns before, right?
No.
What the fuck, dude? Never mind. I thought you were a Gears guy.
Somebody said that. It's like, if Batista was in this, it could have basically been his Gears of War movie.
It is essentially Gears of War, at least the future timeline. It's the, I forget what they call the city, like Jacinto or something. Like, it's the last stand bullshit. It's their ocean city, which is like Zion from the Matrix, right? Because that was another cool, as shitty as the third Matrix movie was. Do you remember the final battle?
Mm-hmm.
I think that was cool as shit, where all the Sentinels are coming through. That gave me this movie gave me vibes of that big time. The weird thing is this has like a double climax, right? Because like the climax of the Tomorrow part of this happens like at the halfway point of the movie.
Muri dying.
What's that?
With Muri dying as an adult.
Yeah, yeah. So that was like the first climax of the movie. And that happens like at the halfway point. And then you get a second climax with another alien fight on the ship or whatever. So they double it up in a sense. But this felt like, and then I literally have it on in the background right now, that scene, that whole slow-mo, him trying to grab her as like she falls into the swarm. Like that's the scene where like it clips. And then you go back and having to do like a whole nother start from scratch, essentially, because you're already into the action or climaxing it in the middle of this. It's weird.
I did like that this one also had the funny thing where they captured the female white spike and then it was like about to break the cage, but then just jumped to somehow it was like being subdued and drugged in a lab with like really no protective elements to it.
Rusty chains.
Yeah, just some chains. You know, that's all we need.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew that thing was going to wake up. They should have used a little more sedative, I guess.
Yeah, that would have been a whole different movie.
It didn't talk about timelines, though, right? Like, this wasn't a timeline movie where things created a new timeline. This was like a one timeline deal.
Yeah, they didn't explain it well enough. They're like, yeah, actually, the jump link is so shitty that it erases all separate timelines anyway. So you don't have to worry about it. You're not going to tear a hole in the fabric of the universe.
Yeah, so then like his daughter died. I mean, that's the thing, I guess, like he re-alters the timeline by going back and then saving humanity, and thus assuming that like he has a new lease on life and doesn't pass away himself. I mean, this really is the best way to think about time travel in terms of just having the most literal interpretation of the events happen.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Because it doesn't break your brain. It's very simple.
Exactly. You don't have to think about it too hard, which I appreciate.
It's a movie that, again, I kind of like wish had a mass for at least like a very wide ranging like theater type release. I saw that reaction from a bunch of people because these are just the things that are elevated when they are in theater. They're bigger, they're grander, the spectacle. I think it would look fucking awesome, even if it wasn't IMAX. Look, it's not great. But I think it's one of those rare, too, where
I actually, like, we've talked about before with, like, this quote-unquote streaming bump. And I saw some people say, too, that they didn't love it as much. Like, oh, like, I had low expectations, and my expectations were raised. People liked it. But me, like, this is the rare one where it almost got hurt by streaming, because I think the spectacle of it was more important than I think a lot of what you get with maybe, like, the screenplay, the dialogue, all that stuff, which wasn't great. So this is one of those ones where I think I would have liked it more had I seen it on the big screen, but I'm pleasantly surprised. There was a, and we'll talk about here in a second what we're going to be reviewing next, but there was kind of a good drop of movies last weekend.
Yeah, that's
stream.
Right.
And we'll do the Steven Soderbergh movie on HBO Max. Fear Street, pretty damn solid on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
Exciting start there. I'm sorry we didn't review The Ice Road. At least
please forgive Netflix, us.
Right?
No Sudden Move on HBO Max will be our next review. So there was a good drop piece, and I think Tomorrow War was included. It's absolutely worth your time.
Yes, agreed.
Does HBO have a streaming deal for the 2022 World Cup?
Or it's Amazon, you mean? Yeah,
Amazon. Sorry, I don't. You know, I thought that was like. I mean. I think the intent, obviously, is the entire world is watching this one event to see the big broadcast message. And it was a cool little setup, but it was like very prominently featured with like actual teams. It was Brazil and who else was it?
Oh, no, Brazil was the one that stands out because they were in the middle of a great chance, by the way, when all of a sudden that time travel guy just interrupted them, kind of fucked up.
Remember when Neymar dies in the beginning of Triple X, the Return of Xander?
Wow. Holy shit, I forgot about that completely. Triple X, Return of Xander Cage.
I imagine like the time link like getting worse every time they use it, and them getting to that specific point in history where that guy's about to score the goal used about 70% of the time link's powers. Like, no, it has to be right here.
This exact moment. This guy's the chance of a lifetime.
Remember how cool the initial designs for the Qatar World Cup stadiums were? Then only like half of them got built.
Yeah.
Also, many more awful things with that World Cup production, like the building of those stadiums, like terrible things.
Yeah.
That's the Tomorrow War. I would say big time suggest.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, don't go in expecting that you're gonna.
It's not an Oscar contender.
The greatest thing ever, but that's not the point of it. It's a fun, albeit kind of dumb. Movie, but it just kind of works enough for what it is. You will have it. You will. I even think if you really dislike it, you're not going to be overly, but like, you're not gonna be like, I wasted my time. You're like, I just didn't love it, but you know, whatever, like decent enough time. No Sudden Move from Steven Soderbergh, big time cast: Don Cheadle, Benicio del Toro, David Harbour, Ray Liotta, John Hamm.
Good ass movie, man.
And who am I missing?
I missed a name here.
The Brendan Fraser.
Yeah, the Fraser man. Yeah, true. He looks great in this movie. Like, just dress wise.
I started watching last night. Like, I didn't realize, like, or I didn't remember how deep his voice is.
Yeah. No, he makes it a little bit deeper deep on purpose, voice. I think, for that one.
It's nice.
Also, I saw The Forever Purge.
The Forever Purge.
What'd you give it?
Yeah. 31 out of 100. Also, our scores for Black Widow are on movierankings.net. If you want to go see what we gave Black Widow, go check it out. I'm not going to say what it is yet. That's a reason to go to the website if you want to know what we gave it. Also, Fear Street on Netflix. I don't know if we'll get to Fear Street. I think maybe we'll do all three of them when they're all out at end of the end month. Of month, right?
Yeah, yeah. The last one, I believe, comes out in something in the 20s. Okay. So
that's we'll on do Netflix. All three at the end. Give that a chance. Also saw Boss Baby, Family Business. I think we both did. You liked it more. I mean, if I could never see, though, we've been getting consistently tagged in videos from Universal Studios, I think, of like Boss Baby mascots. They're like show trill.
Like people dressed up in Boss Baby costume, like a big Boss Baby suit.
Yeah, it's like a mascot Boss Baby.
Like, does that offend you? Does that like, how do you?
The Boss Babies are just like they should buy just like a professional lacrosse team and just name them like the Boss Babies and just have a Boss Baby mask on the sidelines. Why not? You're just gonna keep making the movies.
The only one I haven't seen yet that kind of dropped this last week was Zola. Try to see it in theaters.
That's hard to find. I want to watch that as well.
All right, that's it for our review there. The Tomorrow War, you can go give it a look. Go give it a look on I almost say HBO Max, Amazon Studios, Amazon. Amazon.com. Oh, Jeff Bezos. 70 for myself, Ken Jack 73, Trill of 60. The Tomorrow War with Chris Pratt. That's it. No list of rankings today. A little shorter pods. Apologies, maybe, if you don't like that. We're going to do a cat draft later on in the week.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
We didn't drop our podcast last week. We had some scheduling conflicts and just had to move it. Just couldn't do it. Just one of those things. Just rocking a hard place. So that then resulted in Garfield porn being spammed on our Reddit. And that has inspired us to
understandable.
Do a, yeah, it's just what happens.
Play the hits.
Just play the hits. I have to react and say, like, please stop doing this. But I am laughing. It's dumb. But when it happens, it is funny. We're going to do a cat draft in honor of Garfield.
Cats, you can't baby. Get too explicit. It stops being funny when it's super right. explicit.
That's you. Like,
Garfield with large boobs. Yes.
That's just funny the second you're saying it.
But
yeah.
then there's
yeah.
some of them where it's like, Jesus Christ.
Garfield with a throbbing cock.
Yes.
Big veiny balls.
Like the classic is the muscled out Garfield holding John.
John. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that's the gold standard, and like everything else, it should be in that similar vein. But if it gets too disgusting, it's not what Jim Davis intended.
Veiny cock and balls Garfield is probably the best way to put the line being crossed.
They're just posting it. Somebody drew that.
Yeah, every single person drew. That's all drone.
That's it. For Ken, Jack, and Troll, I'm Jeff Lowe. We'll talk to you next time.
Have a good week at the box office, folks.